prize. I've already got the prize. The prize is the pleasure of finding a thing out.
The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
You realize when you know how to think, it empowers you far beyond those who know only what to think.
And we're live. All right, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Griffins and Gluons. I'm your host, Elliot, and today I'm actually joined by my co-host and the Vice President of External Affairs for the Physics and Astronomy Club, Mr. Callum Wareham. Callum, thanks for coming on. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Elliot. How are you doing?
Not too bad. And I'm actually really excited because we're actually interviewing our former teacher. He taught us Lin Algebra 2 last year. And it's actually really nice. We're going to have a conversation with him. He's Dr. Jeremy Lubbock. Dr. Lubbock holds 2 degrees from the University of Guelph. Firstly, he holds a joint bachelor's degree in mathematics and history and a PhD in mathematics with a focus in linear algebra, matrix theory, and quantum information. From 2015 to 2018, he pursued his postdoctoral fellowship, starting his work at the African Institute for Mathematical Sciences in Cape Town, South Africa, then bringing his research back to Guelph before returning to the University of Cape Town to finish his fellowship. He's the author and co-author of numerous papers and has held teaching positions in Cameroon and Ghana and is currently a lecturer at both Conestoga College and here at the University of Guelph. Dr. Lubbock, or Jeremy, as we will call you from now on, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So it's been a real pleasure. My colleagues and I, including Callum, like I said, we all unanimously agreed that you were a great teacher last year. So this is really nice. This is really great. And I wanted to ask you a bit about your unique degree type for your undergrad. You majored in mathematics and history, is that correct?
That is correct. Okay, that's actually, it's slightly incorrect. I minored in both of them. My degree type did not allow for a major, but I didn't have a major. I have, so effectively they're like equivalent to majors for me.
Were you an arts sci? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I was a Bachelor of Arts and Sciences student, yeah.
Really? Okay, I'm in art side too. Wow, and you got a PhD afterwards.
I did.
That's incredible. Okay, wow. I was still under the assumption that the double minor crowd was doomed after undergrad. We couldn't really go anywhere.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think some people did pretty well with it. Some people have done a lot more impressive things than me with it, so.
All right, well, that's amazing. How come you picked math and history? What were the two sort of motivating factors between those?
That's a good question. It was a while ago. Math was a bit of an accident, to be honest, which is maybe funny given where I am now. I was originally going to go into biology. I thought that was much more interesting. When I was in high school, I really was interested in like evolution and stuff like that, and I anticipated being much more interested in that. So, you know, if you're an arts and science student, maybe things have changed. But in my day, you had to take like the first year math, the first year chemistry, the first year bio, the first year physics. And so in the first semester of first year, I took the math and the bio classes, bio because I had to, and math because I sort of wanted it out of the way. And it turned out I really did not enjoy the bio class at all. There was a lot of stuff that I just didn't find interesting in the slightest. And I really liked the math class. So I sort of put bio on hold and decided that I would take math 12-10 just to see if like I kept liking it, and I did. And somewhere around like my second or third year, I noticed that I had not taken a single biology class in a little while, but I had kind of taken like a lot of math classes, and that maybe I should admit to myself that I was just switching from my anticipated plan. And eventually I did that. History was more something that I knew I was interested in like from the start. I don't know, I've always been interested in it, and so that one I think just felt more natural, like even coming in.
Is there a certain time period or certain type of history that really kind of caught your attention? So Napoleonic era or industrial era or Russian era type thing?
I mean, like when I was a kid, I liked the ancient stuff, you know, like hieroglyphics and ancient Egypt and all that stuff. Nowadays, I'm pretty, anything, you know, I like get into phases where I find something I'm interested in for like a month or two and then go out again. But like after arts and sciences, I would say history of science in particular is something that I have always found really interesting. I think like history of ideas, history of science kind of stuff.
Very cool. And and I'm just curious, because you had two minors and then later went on to grad school, did you have to sort of, for your PhD, did you have to kind of take extracurricular math credits to equate to a full math degree?
Sort of. So in my day, I have no idea if this is still true. In my day, you could get a minor without taking real analysis, which I somehow managed to do. I just like skipped it by.
That can't happen.
I think I had to do something. I don't remember. I don't think I had to take another class or anything like that, but I think I just had to, like, I don't know. I can't really remember. But I think there was, like, something to do with that I had to worry about. I don't really remember it being too big a deal, but it was, like, of note and a concern at the time. I had to prove that I could do real analysis.
Right.
Yeah, that, like, choosing, you know, taking a couple bio classes and then realizing that you don't like biology, even when that's your like degree program you've joined into, that seems to be a fairly common thing. I mean, that's exactly what I have done. I started out in a biochemistry program, and now after first year, I swapped into a physics major because I really didn't like the bio very much. I think that's fairly common.
I just wonder if like bio just front loads their least interesting material. Like I had friends who continued on with bio, and like when they were doing genetics, they would come home talking about stuff, and I'd be like, "Oh, that sounds so cool! Like this is amazing." But like by then it was too late, you know. I couldn't get back into it. I feel like math sort of maybe front loads their best material, and also at least in my day, I think math front loaded their best teachers, which maybe also made a big difference. You would like feel much smarter and like you were kind of learning a lot more from a math class. And then I remember bio, the first class was taught by like four different teachers, some of whom were great and some of whom were less great. And so it was like just a really mixed bag and very much less inspiring. So that's my theory.
Yeah.
Anyone from the biology department is listening, you should like rearrange it, put better material up front. You'll get more students. Maybe they don't want as many students. Maybe it's so popular already that they need to like deflect the least interested.
Well, yeah, it's the opposite of what we do. A lot of our courses are designed to get people into.
Yeah, you know, they like have so many people who know they want to become a vet or whatever that they just need to like turn away all the extras. And we're just so desperate for anyone to stick around that we're like, no, look, math is amazing. Math is amazing. Come stay, please.
And that kind of begs the question of how people are still in chemistry, because they front load the hardest, most ridiculous chemistry course in the first year, and then people are still kind of interested in after.
I mean, I don't know anything about chemistry, but all I will say is that I don't know any of my friends who took chemistry, and I actually liked my first year chemistry class. I had a good teacher for it, but I did not take any more after that. The labs were bad for me in chemistry. I am not an experimentalist at heart.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I want to swap gears a little bit and talk a little bit about your kind of academic background after after grad school as well, or including grad school. You've spent some time teaching and doing research with the African Institute for Mathematical Sciences. And so I just wondered, you know, what led you to take that path? Because that's kind of slightly different from your more traditional path for someone in Canada to kind of do, you either go to the States or you stay in Canada a lot of the time, or maybe you go to Europe, not necessarily to Africa is, you know, the place that would be least likely, you'd think, maybe.
So I don't know how much you guys know about AIMS, the African Institute for Mathematical Sciences. I don't know if you know about David Cribbs's involvement with it.
Very little, to be honest.
Very little, yeah.
Okay, so AIMS is this network of schools in a few different African countries that was founded by Neil Turok, who you may have heard of. He was, until like 2 or 3 years ago, the head of the Perimeter Institute. And he is South African born. He was born in Cape Town. before he went off to Oxford and then eventually coming to Waterloo to do to be the head of Perimeter. And so in, I think in the year 2000-ish, something maybe a little 2003 or 4, something like that, he had this idea that he was going to found this network of schools in his hometown and in his home continent. Basically, his thinking was, as far as I understand it, was that one of the big problems that sort of holds a lot of like really top talent in science and math in Africa back is that there's just not a network to like put you in touch with top institutions. You know, if you're like a really bright student, but you're in Cameroon or somewhere like that, you might just never catch the eye of an institution or a teacher or someone like that who would like recognize that and then put you in touch with sort of better opportunities further on. So the idea was it would be a bunch of university sort of, they're not quite universities, they're academies, I guess. I don't know exactly what they are, but they're centered in these different African countries, and the lecturers come from other places in the world. So the lecturers come from Europe, North America, wherever. And the idea is the students who go there like get to kind of be plugged into the networks of these people from elsewhere. So like you will have a really good lecturer who you like for this course, and then when they go back to France or whatever, you can apply to a master's program in France, and there's someone who knows you and can like vouch for you and so forth and so on. And so the idea was sort of to like plug the African university network and students from it a little bit more into like the global network of these things. And so when Neil Turok was at Waterloo, he was like, I think, fairly active in trying to recruit people from that area to go and be these teachers abroad. So when I was doing my PhD, I was co-supervised by Rajesh Pereira and David Cribbs. And David was one of the people who Neil Turok, I mean, I don't know about personally, but like he was one of the people sort of in the Waterloo region who was convinced to go and teach a course at the AIM Center in Cape Town. And so I was doing my PhD then, and David sort of had this idea that like, it shouldn't just be the teachers, the lecturers who go and teach these courses. There should be kind of back and forth with TAs and sort of other levels as well. And so he wanted this idea that a grad student could go and be like a grad student there for a few months and do a thing there. So I was basically the trial program for that. I went and spent 5 or 6 months in Cape Town while doing my PhD, being a TA at this AIM center there, and it was really good. I really liked it. It was like very different from other learning environments, and I think for the most part in a good way. There were a lot of really amazing lecturers who came, and yeah, I was very, I like really got into it. And so when I came back, I sort of wanted to try and do something there again. So I did a postdoc there just to follow on. And by that point, I had like kind of, I sort of had been back and forth to Cape Town on and off for like a year or something like that. So there's a guy who did his PhD at Waterloo who was teaching at the University of Cape Town for reasons that I don't know how he found his way there, but basically we started like collaborating a little bit while I was at Ames, and then he invited me to do a postdoc with him at the University of Cape Town. So I kind of did that, and I was there for a few years. And yeah, during that, so like these Ames lectureships are only a few weeks long. They're like 3 week courses, but they're just very intense. You do 2 hours every day for 3 weeks. And so while I was sort of doing these postdocs, I would also just do like these 3 week lectureships, you know, one in Ghana, one in Cameroon, which, yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's like a really different method of teaching that I think maybe doesn't suit everyone, but it is very intense, but like I liked it a lot. I found it really rewarding, and it sort of suited my personality, I think. So yeah, that's sort of,
wow. Yeah, it sounds super intense, yeah. Compared to like just your normal, what we would consider over here, normal 4 month, you know, course where you're only in class for 3 hours a week, 2 hours every day is all.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing is, the students have all already completed some kind of university degree. It's more like a master's program than like an undergrad program. You would not like do this to teach someone like basic calculus. The courses are usually more like a little bit. So like I taught quantum computing courses there, basically. So like sort of a little bit higher level of a course, something more like a master's level course. But they have to be completely self-contained. There's like no notion of prerequisites, more or less. It's like pretty crazy. But
and are these positions sort of, I guess the teaching positions would be more open, but for the students, are these positions only open to those with South African citizenship?
It's Pan-African and like very deliberately like fostered a Pan-African identity. They in fact try and make sure that they like break up blocks from the same country a little bit so that you don't have like, you know, they take something like 60 students per year in each like incoming class. And like they will like break up, you know, the Ghanaian students so that there's not like 30 Ghanaian students in the center in Ghana. They'll try and like mix them around a bit. At least they used to. I mean, I haven't been as plugged into it for a little while, but that is what they used to do, at least.
And when you and that sounds very cool and very honorable. Congratulations! And I just want to know when you came back, were you flooded with sort of misconceptive comments like, "Oh, you went to Africa? Do they still have roads there? Do they have electricity?"
Yeah,
there?
I mean,
stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like not a crazy amount, but yeah, like there are people who have unrealistic ideas about what South Africa is like. So I actually have family in South Africa, which I should maybe have said earlier as a reason why I was willing to do this. I don't know if I would have done this if I didn't have like some sense that there were people I would know there so that I didn't just spend 6 months living in total isolation. So like I knew a little bit about it going in, so I was not as like surprised by it, but yeah, I definitely, you get surprised remarks that like, oh, they have universities there, like, yeah, they do. Like, some of them are pretty good.
And I mean, Cape Town, I don't mean to demean anything, but Cape Town has definitely been ranked a relatively dangerous city a few times here and there, so it's good that you had sort of family there and you knew your surroundings or whatever.
Yeah, I like the institute itself is in a pretty safe location. There are like pockets that are very dangerous, like very, very dangerous. I think when I was there, it was the murder capital of the world, for example. If you excluded like active war zones, like not like, you know, Kabul, Afghanistan or something like that. But right. So it was very dangerous, but like it's very stratified, you know, I was not super likely to encounter much of it. And the staff at the place were, you know, they like would warn you about doing stuff. You know, when I got driven to the airport, I got driven by like one of the people from Ames and my flight was really late at night or it gets really early in the morning, but I had to get there at like 2 a.m. and we drove through the shortest route to the airport, goes like just on the outskirts of one of like the really dangerous areas. And there's a traffic light there where basically there's a ton of carjackings. And as we pulled up as we got to the light, it was red. And he turned to me and he said, "I'm not stopping at this light. We're just going through. So just be aware." And we went through, but like beyond that, I didn't really encounter anything.
Yeah.
It was right on the beach. I just like, you know, went on the beach all day. It was amazing. For me, it was very, very pleasant.
Fantastic. Well, I want to touch a little bit on your work right now and what you've probably been doing since working there with quantum information theory, quantum computing. Can you tell us a little bit, and you know, our listeners a little bit, at the undergraduate level, what you work on in terms of what quantum information theory is, what quantum computing is,
yeah,
give us a little bit of a rundown on that.
Yeah, so I guess if this is for physics people, probably people have heard of the notion of a superposition, right? Let me maybe back up a bit. One of the things that I found frustrating when I took quantum mechanics as an undergrad is that it seems to me that there's like a lot of really neat ideas at the bottom of quantum mechanics, entanglement, superposition, you know, all this like weird, crazy stuff that suggests that the world is really not how it seems. And then when you study it, you just spend a lot of time taking these horrendous integrals or whatever. And it seems very easy to get lost in details. And I think for a number of reasons, this was sort of like the physics community actually sort of liked that. They liked this idea that like quantum mechanics was hard, but not like conceptually hard. It was hard because the integrals were really hard. Like that was the, you know, the reason we didn't understand quantum mechanics, like the idea was simple. It's just that you had to, you know, like master all these like hard math techniques. And one of the things that I like about quantum computing and quantum information is I feel like it sort of turned that on its head. But it's a much, much simpler mathematical theory. There's no Feynman diagrams. There's none of that like crazy quantum chromodynamics, all that outrageous stuff where like, you know, you have to do a 30,000 term calculation or whatever. Like, it's like basic linear algebra. You can do like interesting quantum information work with like 4x4 matrices. And yet the ideas are what sort of interesting and surprising. I think a lot of the early conceptual confusion around quantum mechanics has been, if not cleared up, at least like we sort of understand the issues a lot better. We sort of understand the what we don't know a lot better. And a lot of that is in part from the work of quantum computing and quantum information. So why would that be the case? Basically, one of the hearts of quantum mechanics, sort of the simple version, not the version that you would learn in an actual quantum mechanics class, is that at the quantum level, things can be in what's called the superposition. So if I have a coin, it can be either heads or tails, and those are like the only two things it can be doing. And so those are its states, the possible ways that it can be. In quantum mechanics, you have this third thing called the superposition. If you have a quantum coin, it can be in heads or tails, or it can be in a superposition of heads and tails, which is something like being both at the same time. It's something like having a probability of being heads and a probability of being tails, but not quite either of those. We don't really know what a superposition is. We know how to describe it mathematically, though, and mathematically it's actually very simple. It's basically just linear algebra. It's a vector. And a lot of people, I think, foundered on this idea that, like, because we don't understand what a superposition is, either there had to be something wrong about it. So, like, this was sort of the tack that Einstein, and to a lesser extent, maybe Schrodinger, they sort of didn't like it so much. They wanted there to actually be a real state of affairs underneath. But even, like, the defenders of quantum mechanics, people like Niels Bohr or whoever, they were maybe a little, like, embarrassed by it. I think they seem a little defensive. They sort of wanted to act like it was no big deal, that there was just this new way for the world to be that we had never conceived before. Like, ugh, like, you're still asking questions about that? Come on, man, get over it. It's a superposition. What's there to understand? And I think both of those were sort of the wrong approach. So essentially, the idea, there are a few people who had this idea. There was a Russian mathematician named Manin. Feynman was sort of one of the early pioneers of this idea, and a guy named David Deutsch at Oxford all sort of had variations on this idea that we know, like if you build a computer, it's built on bits, on things that can be either a zero or a one. And all computations, whether you do them on a computer or on pen and paper or in your head or however you do a computation, you're essentially manipulating information that can be represented as bits, as zeros and ones. And the reason we've been using zeros and ones is because physically, the world comes down to things that can be one way or the other. But quantum mechanics tells us that that's not true. You can have a computer that's built out of things that can be one way or the other or in a superposition of the two of them. So what if your computer, instead of just doing zeros and ones, what if you put it in superpositions of zeros and ones? Would that make a difference? And the answer is yes, it would. It took a little while to like figure that out. And what the difference is can sort of be very subtle and weird at times. So it was only in like the last 2 years or something like that, I think, that a problem that provably could be solved more efficiently on a quantum computer than on a classical computer emerged. There are a bunch of ones that are almost certainly easier on a quantum computer, but we can't prove it. Basically, just because proving that there's no method on a classical computer that's as good, at, you have to like close off all these weird possibilities that you can't foreclose. So the boundary between them is kind of subtle, but it's really interesting. And I think what I like about it is it sheds light, number one, on the foundations of like computer science and sort of what it means to do a calculation. It also sheds light on the foundations of math. This is something sort of tangential to my current research, but something I find very interesting is ideas from quantum mechanics have really complicated our idea of what it is to do a mathematical proof. And it sheds light on our ideas about quantum mechanics and what the universe is really like. The universe is built on quantum bits somehow in some way, right? Like ultimately we are made out of quantum stuff. We think we don't know what that stuff is. And it obeys the rules of quantum mechanics. So like quantum computing is sort of something very much at the intersection of some very foundational stuff in math, physics, and computer science. And I think it's really helped clarify all of those to some extent or another. So that's what I find really interesting about it. With that said, that's not directly what most of my research is in. My research is mostly in what are called quantum channels, which is, so this arises from another important feature of quantum mechanics, which is entanglement. So the idea behind entanglement is fairly straightforward. In fact, without superpositions, entanglement is not such an interesting idea. Basically, the idea behind entanglement is that if two things interact, they sort of influence each other and they remember that interaction. So like if two billiard balls collide, their momenta going forward are going to like reflect the fact of their collision, right? You know, you bounce and then you move away along paths that remember, oh, hey, remember like 5 minutes ago we bounced into each other. What's right. Interesting is with super, if you throw in superpositions, it says that if you have two things in superposition and they interact and then move away, they will still have to like remember the fact of their interaction. And when you do future experiments, you will get these correlations. But at the time of interaction, it seems like they didn't actually know what they were doing when the interaction happened. So they have to like pick among all the possible things that could have happened when they interacted, and they both have to pick the same thing, and they always do, but like we don't know how, which is very weird and surprising. And so
this is the quantum woo factor.
Yeah, it's very weird. I don't know. It's hard to think about it. But so the point is that one of the things that can happen with a quantum system is, let's say you're doing a quantum computation, and so you have whatever, you know, you've got some atoms that you're using to represent your bits in quantum. You call them qubits because they're quantum bits. And then like a ray of light goes by, hits one of your qubits, and then kind of goes out the window. Well, because it hit your qubit, they're now entangled, right? They interacted, so they have to remember something about the interaction that happened. But now that beam of light, like, left, you don't have any access to it. It's sort of like learned something about your quantum computation and then left with that information. And now that's just gone.
And in that process of leaving, that's the sort of thing that you receive as the experimenter. That's what you measure at the end.
This is the thing. You don't want to measure it, right? You didn't want this. It is like the beam of light measured it, but you didn't. Right. It's like an accidental measurement. It's just like the world just measures things all the time, because, you know, if you have something in a box, like all the light and sound and air molecules that hit that box are going to learn something about what's in that box just by virtue of like interacting with it. And so what happens in that situation is the fact that you can entangle with something else and then that thing can kind of leave your system that you care about, it sort of can take information that you wanted kept in the quantum computation and like carry it away. And so when that happens, you represent that process by what's called a quantum channel, which is basically like the mathematical description of how your initial quantum state kind of changes as it entangles with things and they carry away information. And there's like a really deep and rich mathematical structure there that is basically just some really nice linear algebra and group theory and sort of other interesting ideas in pure math. But it's sort of a, like, thinking about this stuff in terms of quantum channels, like, lets you pose questions that you maybe wouldn't have come up with without the motivation from quantum computing. Like, so the mathematical side of this has been studied since the 70s, I think, or maybe even earlier, 50s and 60s, with, like, some big breakthroughs in the 70s. But there are a ton of, like, very basic questions that people had never even considered until the 90s and 2000s, just because mathematically it maybe wasn't such an obvious question to ask. But, like, from the point of view of thinking of this as quantum information, you want to say, like, oh, well, like, to what extent can I kind of encode my information in such a way that even if this entanglement happens, I don't lose the information? That's like a very, very natural idea from a physics perspective, but the mathematical idea behind it was maybe not so obvious. So there's a ton of work. David Cribbs, I think, did like a bunch of work on this, and some of his other grad students in like the kind of late 2000s, early 2010s or whatever. And yeah, you can do like this really neat math, which is not even too outrageously hard. You know, you don't have to like be solving the Riemann hypothesis or whatever here, because it's the source of these really interesting questions. So that's for the most part where my work has been for the last while.
I actually wanted to ask you about quantum channels, because you referenced the paper called Private Quantum Channels in one of your works, and it kind of outlines sort of the applications to cryptography that quantum computing has. And I just wanted to know sort of the protection between, let's say, a traditional encryption type like RSA, the Rivest Shamir Alderman that is used normally, which is just to encode in a large data set, and then with a quantum channel, or the quantum cryptography for that matter, how does that distinction work? Do you just put, let's say you had a message in something that can't be measured, because once you measure it and interact with it, it's different?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different ways of doing quantum cryptography. So sort of the most classic is you actually do classical cryptography, but you use quantum mechanics to generate your classical password, basically. Like a password, you want to be very random, and quantum mechanics is random, but you also don't want anyone to like peek at your password, and quantum mechanics, you can detect if someone is measuring. So like if you combine those two features of quantum mechanics, you can generate something random and also tell if someone else has been like looking at it. That's sort of the most classical use of quantum cryptography. Private quantum channels are a little more, you basically, they require like a bit more of a specific setup to work. The idea there is that if I want to send you if I want to send you quantum information, so I want to send you like an atom in some superposition, and the fact that you get the correct superposition is really important to me. Like, you need this superposition, your life depends on it, so I need to send you exactly the right superposition. And I don't want anyone else to know it, because for some reason, if they know it, then that's terrible. It's hard to come up with like a reason why this would happen in real life right now, because not many people are trying to steal your quantum information these days. But like, presumably one day that will be a problem, you know? So I want to send you a quantum state, and I don't want anyone else to get access to it. What I can do is I can sort of encode it by like putting it into a different, more random superposition. I like, you know, flip a coin and say like, okay, depending on my coin flip, I'm going to zap it with a laser. I'm going to put it through a magnetic field or whatever it is, and that'll sort of garble it up. But somehow you have to be able to ungarble it in a way that someone else, if they get the garbled message, will only see, they won't know the correct way to measure it to like get information back out. They'll just make random measurements and therefore see random results. And it's sort of about finding the right possible like ways of garbling it, like what the my options are for how to kind of mix the information up in such a way to guarantee that no clever measurements on the part of an eavesdropper can kind of extract information that I don't want extracted. I sort of need to, you know, I can't just be like, ah, well, you know, I'll just put it through a magnetic field, but I won't worry about zapping it with a laser. Like maybe the magnetic field will not hide enough of the information. So I need to like consider both of those. And so that it's sort of it's basically like the mathematics of sort of how much you need to like garble a message before it like is guaranteeably garbled for an outsider. Kind of how much random stuff you need to be willing to do before you can say like no one can figure this out, right? And like the same idea happens in classical. Like if I wanted to send you a message in like Morse code so that it's all in bits, I could just flip a coin, and every time I get a heads, I change a dot to a dash or a dash to a dot, and that will mix up the message and hopefully make it unreadable if it's really random. But if it's not random enough, if I'm just like I will change the first dot to a dash and that's it, probably that's not safe enough. And there's like a sort of set amount of randomness that you need to draw on before you can feel pretty good that your message is actually hidden.
Right. I, by the way, I appreciate the layman's terms of garble and such.
Yeah, highly technical.
I mean, I'll be sure to use that in my paper, in my quantum assignment next.
Honestly, you should. I'm like I'm not a fan of mystification. Like, there's a reason for technical language, obviously. Like, you need to be able to talk about ideas precisely. But, like, also, if you can't explain an idea without the jargon, like, I feel like you don't understand it. I feel like you need to be able to have access to like that kind of more intuitive level of thinking, because like that's how you come up with ideas too. Like no one just like looks at like the definition of a quantum channel. It's like, ah, yes, I see what to do here. You're like, I want to scramble this thing up. How do I scramble? You know, that's like how you actually think about it. So.
Very cool. Well, does it sound like, it sounds like there's a lot of interesting problems to be solved, in that, the field right now. So is that a kind of a field that you would recommend people have a look at for if you're kind of a, you know, if you're a physics major or you're a math major that really likes physics or
I think versa? So it seems to me a pretty good field to be in. I think, you know, it depends on your interests obviously, but like as someone who always liked kind of fundamental physics, I like the fact that it is both very fundamental and also it's not like it doesn't require you to be a super genius. You know, you don't need to master like quantum gravity or something like that. And it's also, you know, if you're more experimentally inclined, there's a ton of actual like experimental work being done at like IQC in Waterloo. People who are trying to actually build quantum technologies and quantum computers. I think it's a pretty exciting field to be in. There's like really crazy new results coming out all the time, sort of in and around kind of physics inspired by ideas from quantum information and quantum computing, let's say. You know, a lot of like the big sort of controversies and paradoxes in physics are a good, maybe not the only way of understanding them, but a good way of thinking about them is from the quantum computing perspective. So like stuff like the black hole information paradox or whatever, even just like quantum gravity itself, I think is the kind of thing that, you know, quantum information offers you an avenue in. And then even if you don't want to deal with like that kind of stuff, there's also just a bunch of cool, interesting math and physics and whatever questions lying around. Or you can just try and build a quantum computer or whatever. Like it's sort of, I think there's enough there to appeal to lots of different interests and motivations. But obviously I would say that because that's like how I see the world. So I see it from that kind of lens. So I think, yeah, like, of course this is the way to do it. But I don't think that's just me. I think a lot of other I shouldn't say other, I'm not a physicist. A lot of physicists have like moved in that direction. And a lot of mathematicians, I think, have moved into becoming a lot more interested in quantum information. Like I know a bunch of people who sort of maybe 10 or 15 years ago were sort of more pure mathematicians in operator algebras or linear algebra or stuff like that, who I think now have a much more explicitly quantum information focus in their research. And I don't think that's an accident. I think it's because it's sort of the place to be. Or at least a place to be. I shouldn't be so exclusive.
Right. Awesome. Cool. Okay. And I also wanted to ask about, get a little bit more philosophical with you. Not that we haven't been a little bit, but just about like linear algebra in general. Obviously linear algebra is super, super central to your research and, you know, most math right now. Most physics too.
I would go further and say most science. I would say pretty much everything is everything is linear algebra.
I wanted to ask, like, why, in your view, is it that way? Like, for what reason does it seem to be that linear algebra is so important? This kind of, you know, you just take two operations basically, and all of a sudden you can represent a whole lot of physical phenomena.
So I would say one reason is sort of because it's easier than calculus, right? Like the idea, it's easier than nonlinear algebra, right? Nonlinear stuff is horrendous, absolutely monstrous. No one can solve nonlinear equations, more or less. The idea behind linear, like in a sense, if you think about what calculus is taking horribly nonlinear functions and linearizing them by looking at their derivatives, right? A derivative is a linear approximation to a generally nonlinear function. And the reason calculus is so powerful is because it's a lot easier to understand stuff when it's linear than when it's not. That's the idea behind like a Taylor series, is you sort of take this function and then you pretend that it's a linear function.
Right, of course.
And that makes your life a lot better. So linearizing a problem is often a way to take a hard problem and approximate it by a less hard problem that is easier. So that's like one reason why linear algebra shows up basically everywhere. So like if you are doing partial differential equations or something like that, unless your partial differential equation has a lot of really beautiful structure, probably what you're going to do is you're going to build a grid and then pretend that a system of linear equations is actually your partial differential equation, and then solve that system of linear equations as a pretty good approximation to it.
Right, of course.
So that's one reason. It's because linear is easy, and you can approximate hard stuff with linear, which is easy, and therefore maybe have a chance at solving it. The other, the like maybe deeper reason, I think... this one I'm a little less sure about, like, speaking categorically. So this is just me thinking out loud a little bit. But I think one thing I really am struck by with matrices in particular is that they can play a lot of different roles. Matrices are algebraic objects, right? You can, like, add them and multiply them and, you know, take polynomials from them and blah, blah, blah. You can represent groups and algebras and other complicated algebraic objects by matrices, so they have a rich kind of algebraic structure. They also are analytic. You fill them with numbers, and you can ask about like convergence and divergence and, you know, open and closed sets and all that kind of stuff from analysis. They're also combinatorial, right? Like if you fill a matrix with ones and zeros or something like that, kind of the pattern of how the ones and zeros fit together is, you know, is related to stuff like combinatorics. I think that's all mathematical objects are like deeply connected in all sorts of ways. Like it's not unique to matrices, but I think matrices are sort of elementary enough that you can sort of understand them pretty straightforwardly. You can get a pretty good sense of them. There's a lot of things like finding eigenvalues, taking determinants, stuff like that, that is like pretty conceptually simple to understand and do, that can be very informative. But you can also capture more complicated behavior. You can capture combinatorial behavior, kind of weird algebraic behavior. If you have like a really hard to understand group, you can find a bunch of matrices that represent that group and then just find eigenvalues and determinants and stuff like that, and use that as a way to kind of approach these more abstract, they're fairly concrete objects, but they can be used to represent and to kind of capture the properties of more abstract objects. And I think maybe lying at that crossroads is what makes them really interesting and useful. There's other stuff too. So one of the things that I think is going back to sort of the relationship to quantum mechanics, there's a really interesting relationship between matrices and graph theory, which is actually, I think, in some ways important to quantum mechanics. My understanding, and I probably don't have the history or the math completely right here, you know, very famously, Werner Heisenberg formulated this version of quantum mechanics that involved matrices, matrix mechanics. And this was sort of in competition to wave mechanics, which at the time, waves were like what physics was all about, right? Like if you think about what physics was like in the early 1900s, it was like electromagnetism and stuff like that was very wave-based. Matrices were like this very kind of obscure corner of math that no one really studied until quantum mechanics. And the way that Werner Heisenberg, stumbled on matrix mechanics was he noticed that if you looked at like how atoms, you know, they were trying to understand like spectral lines and atoms and stuff like that, and kind of the transitions between different energy levels. And what he noticed was that different kind of paths, you could go from like one energy, you could go from energy level 1 to 2 to 3, but not from 1 to 3 to 2 or whatever. Like that sort of didn't seem to happen. And so it seemed that the path that you took kind of mattered. And so you could represent the possible paths in these transitions as a graph. And then what led him to matrices was this deep connection between matrices and graph theory. And graph theory is also very, very deep and very, very connected to a lot of things. It's also combinatorial, it's algebraic, it's topological, it's geometrical, it's kind of got like all those sorts of connections. And so I think that's maybe another aspect of matrices. I think maybe it's like kind of matrices and graphs together are sort of these objects that can wear so many different hats, that you can represent so many different things. And I sort of think that might be part of it.
And I wanted to actually ask you about that relation to quantum mechanics real quick for something that you talked about in a few of your papers, which is mixed unitary rank. So to someone who hasn't really delved into the depths of it, mixed and unitary combined don't sound very quote unquote linear. That sounds very much like an oxymoron, how there's something that could be, you know, of a different state that all follows one type of, you know, form. So I just wanted to know, do you mind just running down what you meant by a mixed unitary rank and what the kind of findings from that was?
Yeah, so mixed unitary channels are, this is actually kind of related to the stuff about privacy, quantum privacy, and private quantum channels. Basically, a unitary is it's something that like doesn't change the geometry. It keeps right angles, and it keeps lengths the same. So when if you like multiply two vectors by a unitary, the geometry of those vectors stays the same. So they're kind of like, they preserve information, you can think, right? You know, like a rotation or something like that. It's just moving it slightly, it's changing your frame of reference, but it's not really changing anything fundamental about the system. And in quantum mechanics, we mostly believe that things behave unitarily. Unitary dynamics is what you get from the Schrodinger equation. It basically says that, like, if I have a quantum state which I can represent by a vector, and then some stuff happens, and I have some new vector a little bit later, there was a unitary that took me from my starting vector to my end vector. But then there's this idea that what happens is entanglement creeps in and steals some of the information about that unitary. So I had, like, you know, from someone who can see every single particle in the world, no information was lost, everything was unitary. But for me, who does not have access to all the information in the world, I had some quantum information and some of it left. And that process of not of losing information is non-unitary. A random unitary is the situation where I lost information, which is mixed and random unitary are two different terms for the same thing. So you asked about mixed unitary and I'm answering about random unitary, but they're equivalent. It's just different terminology. So a mixed unitary or a random unitary is the situation where I did lose information. So I lost that unitariness, but I can sort of describe the way in which my information got lost as being a probability of like different units. So like there's a probability P1 that I lost information because one unitary transformation sort of carried my information away, and a probability P2 that a second unitary carried my information away in a different way. It's sort of the unitary part is saying how the information kind of evolved, and the mixed is saying I don't know which one of these is true. I am pretty sure that a unitary happened, but I don't know which one. That's the way in which I don't have information. So it's sort of describing the overall dynamics is unitary, but your knowledge of it is what's mixed. You're not sure which of these unitaries actually happened. And so the best you can do is say, look, there's a chance that this happened, or a chance that this happened, or a chance that this happened. And so what I can say about my quantum state at the end of this is sort of only as much information as is left to me after considering all of those possibilities and sort of seeing like what would happen in each case and comparing them together. That's sort of the idea. I don't know if that was a great explanation.
You have sort of a set of information, but you can't exactly distinguish it in the frame of reference that you have. And the frame of reference that you need to kind of distinguish everything is something that we can't access. So we have to express it as a probability.
Exactly. Okay. This is like a very thematic thing in quantum.
It sounds very metaphysical, actually.
It is, but it's also very physical. It's basically entropy, if you like, right? What happens is you have this quantum system. It interacts with the world, which it does because of entropy. Things interact. And then those things will kind of move off elsewhere and carry some of that information with them. That's sort of a kind of information-y restatement of the second law of thermodynamics, is that information just leaks out. You know, things kind of... You can't keep a system isolated forever. Eventually, information from it will leak out. And if it's quantum information and it leaks out by means of entanglement, then you kind of can't make measurements on the part that left directly anymore. And so you sort of lose some of that information. So from the point of view of the universe as a whole, no information was lost, we think. If you could keep track of every particle, you would know what was going on. But because you can't keep track of every particle, your state of knowledge can only be described by this much more jumbled, mixed thing. So again, that should sound like entropy for people who know about entropy, this idea that like you can't keep track of the details of every particle. So you kind of discuss the like high level properties that are sort of invariant under, like, you know, it's regardless of what every individual particle is doing, I at least know the temperature of this thing, right? That's like the sort of thing you do with entropy. It's a similar idea here. You say, look, I don't know exactly what happened to my particle, but like there are some high level properties that I can describe, and based on sort of the probabilities involved, that determines what the high level properties are. So that's what a mixed unitary channel is. It describes the situation where you know that you lost information. You kind of know the possibilities of how the information was lost, but you're not sure which possibility it was. And so you kind of just have to deal with this kind of uncertain state of affairs. And so in that paper on mixed unitary rank, the mixed unitary rank is the number of units. So it's like now it becomes mathematical, like the physical motivation dropped away pretty quickly. But it's kind of interesting to say what's sort of the smallest number of unitaries, the smallest number of things that might have happened to describe like how I got to this uncertain state of affairs. And basically, it's probably a little too technical to describe in an interesting way in anything less than like 10 minutes. But basically, there were some unknown questions about... you can also write this state of affairs without using unitaries, which I don't want to get into. Basically, if you have a mixed unitary channel where there are like all these different possibilities that happened, you can also write it in a more compact way that does not require you to use unitary matrices. And there was this question of how big a gap could there be between the sort of the non-unitary way of writing it and the unit, because unitaries are more specialized, you can't use fewer unitaries, but in theory you could use more. And as far as I know, until like about a year ago or so, maybe a little bit more, no one had really found any examples where there was a gap between the number of unitaries necessary and the number of non-unitaries necessary, even though in theory we knew that there could be. And then a guy at IQC, Mark Gerard, who is one of the co-authors on that paper, he found an example where there was a gap, where to do this channel using non-unitaries, you could do it with three non-unitaries, but you needed four unitaries. And so we were interested to see, like, could you get a bigger gap? You know, like what properties of this kind of example that he found were at play underneath it. And so Mark and a bunch of other people at IQC were working on this paper for a while, and they had a whole bunch of stuff. And someone... So I was working with Vern Paulson at IQC. My postdoc is sort of a little bit split between Guelph and IQC. I'm sort of partially supposed to be working with Vern there, even though with COVID there hasn't been so much of that lately. He was like kind of mentioning problems to work on, and he mentioned this problem and this example. And I came back with sort of... a proof of an upper bound on how big the gap could be at the exact same time as Mark Gerard, the guy who found the original example, came up with the exact same theorem, but with a somewhat different looking proof. And so we decided that we should probably combine forces. And so we did. We found out that Mark and I basically did have the same proof, just sort of under different guises. And what we managed to do is we managed to find an example, a kind of class of examples that you can use to make this gap as big as you want by like just picking the right example. And what was very nice is that the way I kind of came up with the example was by taking another idea from quantum information, something called a mutually unbiased basis, which is basically the kind of thing that underlies the uncertainty principle. A mutually unbiased basis is like basically a bunch of measurements that all kind of maximally obey the uncertainty principle. And you can use something like that. You can kind of take one of those unbiased bases and use it to build a quantum channel that has this crazy gap between the unitary number and the non-unitary number. Right. So yeah, I don't know. Like, to be honest, it's a bit of a dry sounding thing to describe in practice, but the example I think is very nice, and it sort of generalized Mark's idea and tied it in with this other kind of neat thing in quantum computing. So it's more interesting than I'm maybe making it sound, I think, but then I would think that. So
yeah, no, I'll take your explanation and I'll reread the paper, you know, before bed. It's light reading, you know. I'll just
The problem is, like, you know, it's hard to like go into these things without a bit of background.
Yeah,
it's tough.
I mean, it preoccupies, you know, departments. you know, the time of departments and very brilliant, you know, people. So it's not meant to be easy, of course.
Yeah, but it's also not hard. It just sort of, I don't know. I feel like I don't want to be discouraging. Like, it is actually, it's straightforward, but you just need to, like, get used to it, I guess.
Right. It's a language.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's like a bunch of ideas that, like, once you get familiar with them, it's like not too, it's like, so the one of like the major proofs in that paper is basically just the rank nullity theorem, which, you know, I taught you guys last year in linear algebra. That's like basically the proof technique, but like you kind of need to recognize it for what it is in this weird setting. That's the hard part. It's just like getting comfortable enough with the setting to be like, oh, I see, this is just rank nullity, like, duh. But
right,
you know, so yeah, that's I think I, you know, it is,
no, yeah,
I think it is a topic where you can read fairly high level papers and with a bit of linear algebra and like some time actually come away with a good understanding, which at least if you're me is not something you can do with like a quantum gravity paper or whatever. So
right.
But like it, you do have to at least spend some time just grappling with the notation and whatever.
No, that's wonderful. Yeah, thank you for that explanation. I'll listen through it again so I can get it properly. But we just hit an hour, so we're gonna wrap up. But before that, Callum, do you have any other questions before we wrap up?
Yeah, just one more, really quickly, Jeremy. I was wondering what for like young people who are currently going through their undergrad and surveying the kind of academic landscape right now for where they perhaps see themselves in the future, in like a few years, you know, what do you recommend in terms of like, how do you find the best place for you?
Or God, I'm not the right person to ask that question to. I don't know. Like, I'm not, I really am not sure that I should be answering this question. I will give maybe some general principles that I think should be pretty good, but I really do not want to give anything specific because, yeah, I do not think that I should be
speaking
with any authority on something like that. I think it's important to be interested in what you're doing. I think it's important to like the people you're working with. Like, if you're going into grad school or whatever and you want a supervisor, you should not stick with a supervisor who you don't get along with. I think that would be very bad. Make connections. This is something that maybe this is me as a counterexample. This is how I can give advice. Don't do what I did, which was to maybe sort of let, you know, when you're a grad student, you're going to feel a lot of imposter syndrome. You're going to think like, I do not belong here. I'm an idiot. How can I possibly, you know, you're going to go to conferences and just like sit there quietly and hope that no one notices you or whatever. Don't do that. Ask questions, meet people. The more people you talk to, the more you will get a sense of what your options are. Who is out there who can sort of offer you things, who can suggest opportunities for you, and also who can suggest like avenues of that might interest you. You really want to be... Yeah, you kind of want to like put yourself out there, I guess. Like you should be taking opportunities to talk with other people and just sort of get a sense of what is out there. You know, like I can't tell you what is a good idea, A, because I don't even think I ever figured that out for me, and I certainly couldn't tell you that for you. But if you talk to enough people, probably someone can tell you that for you, or at least give you enough ideas to help. So that's like my very generic, very bland thing. It sounds obvious, but I don't know. Again, like if you're like me, I think it's very easy to sort of let the feeling that maybe you don't really belong here like dominate, and you shouldn't do that. Everyone feels that way. You are gonna feel dumber than everyone else around you at the start. That's just unfortunately part of it, but like the way to get over that is to like talk with the people who are smarter than you and let them enlighten you, and you should do that kind of early and often.
Yeah, and it's funny because when I started my program, I think I found more people admitting that they were wrong or dumb than I ever have in my entire life. You go to any other kind of gathering and people will think that they're top dog, but you meet people that are, you know, really involved in sort of complicated and you know, work that requires a lot of passion and drive, and they'll go, yeah, no, I'm so silly. I'm so dumb. Everyone else is so much smarter. And imposter syndrome is very, like, it runs throughout, I think, every undergrad program. A lot of people feel that way.
Unfortunately, it doesn't go away that quickly either. It persists long past the undergrad too, unfortunately. But, like, I think it's important to, like, hear from people who I think people think that they're the only ones who, like, okay, like, fine, like, you know, I have imposter syndrome, but I, like, deserve to have imposter syndrome. Like, I am one of those people who doesn't belong. Like, of course, like, that person could never think that, but, like, everyone does think that. Like, everyone, you know, it's just a part of the territory. The problem is that math and physics are so big that everyone is dumb compared with what there is to know.
And the more you climb up the mountain, the taller you realize it is. That kind
of thing. Exactly. So, like, the true wisdom is, like, being like, yes, of course I'm dumb. How could I not be? But I think when you see people who know more than you, you just think, like, you just compare yourself to them and are like, oh, I could never even achieve what they have. And that's probably wrong. And it's important not to let that feeling kind of dominate you and foreclose opportunities for you.
Right. No, yeah, that's great advice. Thank you. I'm sure there are many listeners who would find that valuable as well. But unfortunately, that'll have to wrap up our time. And before we go, we just wanted to know, for the listeners out there and those sort of tuning in, where can they find more about you, about your work, and sort of check out more of the things that you do?
Unfortunately, I do not have a good answer to that question. I started making a website a little while ago, but I kind of touched it in a while.
Just Google.
Google Scholar, I guess, has my papers on it, archive. I will maybe try and get better at that and put my stuff up on it.
Fair enough.
But at the moment, I don't have anything great. I'm sorry.
Right, we'll just Google Jeremy Levick. And Dr. Jeremy.
There is actually a semi-famous Jeremy Levick. I think he used to write for The Onion or something like that.
I follow him
on Twitter. I'm pretty sure when I was, like, I don't know, much younger, when Facebook was, like, a new thing, I'm pretty sure he friended me on Facebook just because we were, like, we had the same name. And then I never thought of it for whatever, 15 years or something like that. And then, like, a little while ago, I was like, wait, that guy's got my name. What's he doing? So there is another one out there, but I think we're pretty easy to distinguish. Our content is generally pretty different.
Unless it's all a big prank and everything you've written so far is just an elaborate scheme to...
Yeah, this is all going to go into my long-term Onion article ploy.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Overcomplicate. math is fake.
Area man fakes quantum computing career.
To get on this podcast, and it worked.
Yeah.
But anyway, that works. But we're gonna wrap up. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks again for having me.
And Callum, thank you for coming on and co-hosting.
Thank you for having me, Elliot.
Adding way more IQ points to the room to help me out, so I appreciate it.
Cheers.
Thank everyone for tuning in. Like we said, we upload once a week, so stay tuned. And gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on, and stay safe out there.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you. Awesome.
This episode of Griffins and Gluons was brought to you by the Physics and Astronomy Club at the University of Guelph. Stay tuned on our Instagram and Discord to hear more about our events and fundraisers that'll be happening all throughout this semester and next semester. Follow our Instagram at UOGPAC, that is UOGPAC, and our Discord, UofGPAC, that is UofGPAC. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next one. Take care.